introduce, and we'll kick off our program, I'd like to introduce John Soper.
Thank you very much, Brian. And I think I've got a lavalier here going. Is that working? Okay, so I'm going to give you an extra microphone. Thank you, Brian, and congratulations, Tom. Well deserved. So, I think we have an exciting program tonight. I think it's timely, and I think it's a very interesting look at the dynamics of small and large companies. And we at ASAP are nothing but, if not, research-oriented before we come to one of these. So we have the authoritative book, Life the Odds, and it says, it's actually researched, the odds of dating a supermodel, male or female. And they come out with 88,000 to 1 are your odds. But they tell you all the ways that you can improve your odds. So when we're done with this panel, I'm sure that we will know whether they're similar to the odds of getting a date with SAP or Cisco or any one of their counterparts and how to improve those odds. So let me first start by introducing our panel. I'm actually going to let them talk for a couple of minutes about themselves and their roles in alliance management for their companies and what they're doing. So let me start with that, and then we'll dive in with some questions, and then I'll open it up to Q&A. First, I'd like to introduce Rick Towaniak from Cisco Systems. He's the Senior Manager, Marketing Manager for the IP Communications Business Unit. And Rick, I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about your background and what you do at Cisco.
Sure. I've worked for Cisco now for 5 or 6 years, all of it being managing partner programs. First starting, always IP communications, so Cisco is broken up into various business units. The IP communications business unit has the largest partner program inside Cisco. So we have about 500 total partners inside Cisco, and I manage about 300 of them, so I have a small team that manages those partnerships. And like I said, I've been doing it for 5, 6 years now. Kind of have a dual role here because I came into Cisco through acquisition as a partner. So I came from a very small company, startup company of 70 people, and I was the vice president of business development and had to partner with Cisco and eventually got acquired by Cisco. So that's how I came in. So I sort of know it from both sides, being coming from a small company as well as now managing the program that deals with partners. So look forward to talking with all of you and sharing my insights. And now I'll introduce you.
Just a quick comment. No, you're spurred a comment that the panel is nicely divided into two supermodels and then two people who have or are pursuing them. And all of them have worked on the other side of the aisle. So they've been pursued, they've been pursuers, so everybody can speak to all the issues. But I think it's great that we have some people here representing roles right now that are on other sides of the aisle, and the next person is...
My date.
Your date, yes.
Right?
Well, not only your date. No, I understand. You got married, didn't you?
Exactly. Yeah, we did.
But we're going to hear about the courtship and how
that worked.
That's right. So, Manoj Fernando is co-founder and the EVP of Business Development at Lightscape Technologies, and I'm going to let... and a partner of Cisco. And I'm going to let him talk a little bit about his background and company.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here and share my views on how we ended up dating Cisco. When the topic first came out, actually, I thought I was the supermodel. It was fair to say it was actually Rick. So okay, well, I can tell you some stories about him. So I'm happy to share some of those experiences. I've been in the industry pretty much in the Silicon Valley for about 20 years right now. Worked in a variety of positions, worked with several different companies, Mosaic, Lucent, I've been acquired by Lucent. Been on ventured out on my own probably late during the dot-com days, in the early part of the days. Had an offshore development company of my own, switched to, got greedy, raised a little bit of money, did the dot-com thing, went bust, you know. The usual story. And about... I think towards the early part of 2000 was when I started a company called Circle 24, and that's when I first got introduced to Rick and Cisco, and then Circle 24 eventually became Lightscape. And today I kind of manage business development and continue to chase Cisco at every given opportunity, plus some of the other large companies around the world as well. So.
Okay, next we have another supermodel, Kevin Itchfnari from SAP. He's the Global Vice President for Business Development. And Kevin, if you talk a little bit about what your role is and maybe highlight us a little bit on what the NetWeaver Equity Fund is and how that plays into your role.
Sure. So I head up the business development efforts for our software partner program globally, and that includes all of the go-to-market relationships we have with ISVs. So I've been at SAP about 3.5 years. I lead a team in the U.S. and in EMEA as well as Asia-Pacific. We also have the NetWeaver Fund, which is a $125 million fund that we put together about a year ago, where we're taking active equity investments in strategic software partners. So we saw the need that when we do, particularly when we invest in small companies, our discussion topic of today, is we needed to be able to help companies scale their operations, build out the appropriate sales and distribution channels, as well as show customers that SAP is truly behind the relationship. So as such, that was the genesis of the NetWeaver Fund, where we actively make equity investments in companies that we partner with to help build out the operations and show that credibility with customers. Prior to SAP, I've been in the technology sector for about 15 years in mergers and acquisitions, venture capital, and business development. And also in my venture capital days, was responsible for forging relationships for my small portfolio companies with big companies like SAP and Microsoft and IBM. So I've been on the other side as well, and it's definitely challenging on both sides of the house.
Okay. Thank you. And finally, but not leastly, Camille Grand, who's the Vice President of Channel and Sales Operations at Cossack Corporation.
Camille. Thanks, John. So I, like everyone else on the panel, been at this for a number of years, almost 25 years it's looking like now. I feel very strongly about this space, so it's an honor to be here to talk about this. I'm at Cossack Corporation. We're in the data center automation space, utility computing, and green data center effectiveness. And we are a supermodel wannabe, so would love some of your funds and would like to be like you. But I also have a long history of actually being on the larger business side. I actually started with IBM for a number of years, was head of business development role there for various divisions, a number of years at Oracle, ran channels there for a number of years, and then BEA and a couple little startups in the middle of all that as well. So I've seen both sides and many different sides, I think, of the effort of partnering. So throw your challenging questions our way.
Oh, we will. Here they come. Thank you very much. What a great panel. Okay. It all starts with a date. So my first question is, when you're trying to figure out who you want to date, just as any other situation, you've got to kind of source your dates. I think that from a small company perspective to a large company perspective, you have different processes and criteria that you use. Usually a small company has maybe a few focused people they want to go at. A large company has a huge array, that half of whom or most of whom they don't even know. So in trying to source who your target is, what's the process you go through? And I'll ask Rick if you'll start, but please, anybody just jump in at any point during this conversation with your comments.
Well, for sourcing, it's somewhat easier on the large side because being Cisco, most people come to us. So it's somewhat a challenge just keeping up with all the companies that approach you. So part of it is dealing with that. But when we are sourcing, there's some various obvious ones. We look at our competitors and look at who their partners are and try to see what technologies are there and see if there's anything interesting. Then there's the typical trade shows. You know, we spend a lot of time on floors and just walking around visiting trade shows. And then we're in an effort. And I would say the trade show is fairly important because we're also out there now trying to build out not only our partner network but our developer network, which is a little bit different. I'm involved in both those areas. So we actually, you know, go after development communities that exist. So, you know, we look at an SAP partner program or a Microsoft Visual Studio developer network, MSDN, or kind of look at those communities and see how we can outreach to them, let them know what we're doing with our partner program to hopefully attract them to come into our program. So I guess it's a lot of different ways. You know, probably the newest way is, you know, not focusing on yourself, focusing on other communities that have built up big programs, and seeing if we can, get some of those companies to think about developing for Cisco also.
Okay. Well, Ash, do you want to say a few words about how you sourced Cisco?
Oh, that's a long story.
Well, not what you did, not how you got them to date you, but just, why you picked them. I think in your case, being that you're an IT company.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Go ahead.
One of the things I mentioned is, when the .com went bust, basically, one of the last projects that we took on was a development program for a company that was doing some work on Cisco when Cisco started introducing IP telephony into the market. So when I first looked at that Cisco phone, there was something there saying, and Cisco's just entering the market at that point. And when you started doing more research, you started seeing this 800-pound giant going after the industry, saying IP telephony is the way for the future. These are all the great things we can do with it. So when you looked at that device, which is the original IP phone that they had, it looked like there was an opportunity to provide a variety of applications to run on that device. Right? So as a result of doing that, that's when you went out and said, okay, who is the market lead? Who is heading the industry? And there were the traditional PBX vendors, but you saw Cisco pretty much making the charge. And our bet at that point was, okay, let's take a look at this. Let's see what Cisco is doing, and then go from there. Because typically at that point, it was like, you can't go wrong. If Cisco is betting their future on this particular technology, then there might be an opportunity there. And that's how we started the whole engagement process of going up Cisco. And I'm sure that's going to come in the next couple of questions.
Yes.
So we go to market by industry at SAP. So when we look at partner types, we take a very structured approach. Across all of our 28 different industries, we formed what we call an industry value network, where we bring together our best customers and partners to collaboratively innovate. So within each of our industries, what we've done is we've brought in our best customers to look at where is the industry spend taking place. So as an example, whether that may be compliance and banking or HIPAA and healthcare, we take a look at where is the industry spend taking place. Then we compare that. So we take an outside-in view of the world. We then look at what processes we support and where are there gaps or white spaces, if you will, within our solution stack. And once we've identified those white spaces based on our customer feedback, we prioritize a market opportunity where there's the biggest opportunity from our field sales perspective as well. We vet it with our product teams, our field teams, and the customer, and bring together the appropriate partners to piece together end-to-end solutions to solve these specifically industry problems. So we have a very... in order to really do this, you have to have transparency. So one of the things SAP has done is made a big shift from the monolithic we-do-it-all approach of taking the platform of our underlying applications, extending it to partners so they can build on it and have their interoperability, but secondly, sharing our roadmaps. So we've become very transparent, as I talked about earlier, these different industries. You can go to our website today, and partners can see where are those white spaces within our solutions. They can actually apply to be one of the partners that fills into one of those white spaces. So really that transparency of looking at for the roadmap for the partners combined to looking at your own solution stack and the industry spend, identifying those partners, we can proactively go out and find those partners. Secondly, we have a whole influx, much like at Cisco, of partners coming to us that we can prioritize based on those white spaces and the market opportunity in those white spaces. So it's very much an industry-driven approach, very much looking at the gaps within our portfolio.
Thank you. Camille, do you want to add something to that?
As a small company, sourcing a partner is a lot of decisions about who not to have a partnership with versus who to have a partnership with. And I tend to turn down partnerships more than I pursue with the idea that if you spread yourself too thin, you never really achieve kind of the results you need with any one partner, and that's what you need. But the sourcing strategy for me starts with a very selfish agenda. I take a very sales or revenue-based objective from a metric standpoint, less to do with the marketing or perception of the partnership and more to do with the outcome and the results. And with a very selfish, narrow point of view, it's we need to generate revenue. We need to generate revenue more rapidly than we could on our own. And then, to Kevin's point, kind of the market map or the spend strategy then plays into it. So what are the key components, let's say from a bill of materials kind of standpoint, that the customer is actually looking for to complete the solution, and where are the weak spots in what we deliver and how we go about delivering that that can be supported by some other play. And then I think to the other point that was made, which is then you go look at who are the largest players in that list who can actually play a biggest role for you. So I take a very inward kind of what is our objective, very well defined. In the first 12 months, I want to generate $1 million of revenue in the following segment. Who are the ways that I can, what are the key players that can help me get there and build the model from there? So before getting to a joint value proposition or anything, really know what your own core metric is.
I want to do a quick add-on to what Kevin said, and it spurred, reminded me that the industry vertical thing is extremely important. So when you're looking to partner with Cisco, one of the ways we kind of stratify in tiers is those partners that hit an industry vertical that's a critical focus vertical for us that fill a gap, same thing, and provide value in that industry vertical typically get to the higher tiers in our partner program. And we just launched the whole industry vertical partner program, which is one of the reasons why Manoj and Lightscape have done so successfully, because they took a lot of their technologies and they focused on particular verticals and filled some gaps and really helped increase our sales in those verticals. And that was, you know, when you got 300 companies that you're working with or 500 or whatever, that was one of the key ways that they were able to kind of separate themselves from other people. So we noticed them. And now we have a focus on verticals very similar to SAP.
Thank you. Okay, so now you know who you want to source. You know who you want to date. And the next question that I have for you is, and this is more directed to the small companies, but I'd be interested in any of your comments. So Camille and Manoj, how do you get that date? How do you make the kind of noise? How do you get the attention so that they will start to look at whether at least they want to take the next step with you?
Well, I think Richard's comment speaks volumes to the key thing, which is what are the strategic initiatives going on at the large companies that they're paying attention to, and how do you become the enabling function to that? So that's one strategy. To me, though, it all always comes down to one key thing. Are there deals? Is there a top-line revenue opportunity that creates new momentum for the larger company to say, wow, this is a changer for us, some sort of game-changer strategy for our business that we couldn't otherwise get to? So can we accelerate revenue faster than, for instance, Cisco could on their own? If you can find the 1-2 punch, if it's a strategic initiative and you can generate faster than they can on their own, then you're likely to get pushed to the top of the list. But for me, it's always come down to one simple thing, and it's you build a pretty close relationship with a coach inside of a large company who befriends you with enough insight as to what it is the key strategic things are. Going on for that business that you really, really get close to and you really focus on, and then turn that into an opportunity, a real customer opportunity.
So what I'm hearing is a value proposition that you both see value in, but in the end you need the inside coach, the inside sales to make it happen.
You got to build a personal relationship. Yeah. I mean, it's like selling to an individual customer in the same way, and if you take it on with that kind of mentality, it's about closing a deal.
Manoj, do you want to comment?
So from Lightscape, or from my perspective, a lot of that is primarily based on here is an opportunity that you're looking to start a company or start something new. And at that point, you decide, you know, who is the horse that you're going to ride, right? In this case, you pick Cisco. And we started going after Cisco in so many different ways, I mean, just to get engaged with them. One is through the formal partnership program, which they have. And the other one is how do you engage with Cisco and how do you differentiate the solution that you're trying to offer to Cisco to make them one of your key partners or have them take you to various opportunities. And that became probably the biggest distinguishing factor for us, because what we ended up doing was, you know, you looked at what Cisco was doing, you know, coming up with this whole technology with voice over IP. And what we did at that point is saying, hey, Cisco is doing this thing to the industry. Here is the value add that we can bring to Cisco, right? Or what is the differentiator? So even when Cisco was going out and competing, you know, with some of the other vendors, established companies in the PBX industry, Lightscape at that point was able to come back with Cisco and say, here's the added benefit of what you're trying to do, right? So in so many ways, as much as we were, you know, going after Cisco and saying, look what we've got. And we started taking more of a vertical approach. So from education to legal, that's where we got our first break-in. And it so happens that the person I chased after legal is in the audience as well here today, right, Brian. So it was one of those approaches that we started to take, saying, let's take a vertical approach that allows Cisco to go and say, hey, I have a complete solution in a vertical industry, whether it be education, legal, or retail. And that allowed us to kind of differentiate ourselves, even with the Cisco teams, to say, here's a solution that now we can say, you know, it's tied into all the backends in the various verticals. So that helped us differentiate ourselves and actually go after Cisco in so many ways and stand out compared to some of the, you know, the 300 other partners that they had in the program as well.
I can't emphasize enough how important that is and what you just mentioned, and that is that the integrated solution. Many companies come to partner with us and they talk about the value to our customers, which is a good start. But it is so critical to build the joint value proposition that's based on the integrated solution. How does 1 + 1 = 3, right? And so very, very much focused in on that. And secondly, looking at the sphere of influence. I think one of the challenges that small companies have when partnering with big companies is they have a great solution that's valuable to the customer base. But is the large company, is it something that they sell? Is it something that they even talk to the right buyer in the account? Is it within their sphere of influence? We deal with this quite a bit as an applications company. We talk to a certain buyer, certain business users within an account. And oftentimes we get companies, let's say it's a security company. It's not that our customers don't need security. They absolutely need security. But it is outside of our sphere of influence. It's not the conversation that our account executives are having with the customer. So really making sure that you focus in on the integrated joint value proposition and also the sphere of influence, understanding that go-to-market model of the big company you're trying to partner with is critical.
If I can just add one more thing to that. Even when we first came up with the idea of doing solutions, you know, with Cisco on this, we had no idea what an education vertical would look like or what a legal vertical would look like. But by engaging Cisco at all levels, right, from the partnership level to the sales to the system engineers, you just kept going to them and saying, hey, what is it that you need? What is it that you need? We have this great idea or this concept. And little by little, when you eventually got to the customer, I remember one of the first customers we actually met was Wilson Sonsini. They never bought the product, but at least they gave us the idea, right? They said, this is what we need. So that allowed us to really go in and say, okay, here's the first product that's coming out that is a requirement on this particular for this particular application, and that's how we basically got started with the first vertical app would be legal. So I never thought I'd lead with lawyers first, but it happened.
I would add to this something pretty basic, because I get hit by partners all the time, is you'd be amazed on how many people hit me up that really have no clue to what Cisco's looking for. And you just wonder, have they researched us? Have they even gone to our website? And, you know, a classic example, if you actually took the time to understand Cisco, you'd know that they're a leader in routers, and we own a fairly large market share. We also have new technology. So when I have companies that come into me and say, you know, we're going to help you sell more routers, I'm kind of going, well, have you really looked at our, you know, do you know that our company has a pretty good market share in routers, and that pretty much anybody who does anything on the Internet is going to help sell us more routers? That's great. But it's the advanced technology. And so, you know, Manoj coming into me and saying, this new business that you're starting up where you don't have market share, I can help you grow that market share. And, you know, here's the vertical and here's what I can do for your customer. That's somebody who has more of a clue in how to deal with us. And I would say there's very few people that come to me with kind of the way Lightscape came to us. And I get more of the, we're going to help you sell more routers. And so really studying your company and finding out what's important to them is probably pretty critical. It's very basic, but people miss it all the time.
To add to that, I think it's very important that you tailor your message on who you're talking to within an organization. So if you're talking to product teams or you're talking to alliance teams, they'll often focus in on purely what's best for the customer. But you're also going to have to integrate with the field sales organization of the large company. And much like any account executive at any company, they are driven by the quarter. They have to make their quota. And they're focused in on how does it generate, you know, new routers or new licenses. And you really have to help them understand how does it drive incremental revenue for them. And so depending on who you're talking to in the organization, very, very critical that you tailor your message. And when you're dealing with a field sales organization, it's imperative to tie it to incremental revenue.
Maybe we beat this horse really well here, but there's a tactical point, which is you show up for the presentation, and I think Richard and Kevin have both said this, that you know, to be very tailored, have a presentation that is quite tailored. The actual PowerPoint that you use is not a PowerPoint about your company, about your product, but it's about the integrated solution. It's about the integrated offering, about how the integrated offering benefits a joint customer. When I was at DEA running alliances there, I mean, kind of like Richard's point, a lot of ISVs would come in and would spill their story about the benefit of their technology in the generic Java environment. Well, DEA had a very specific agenda relative to the Java class applications, and if it wasn't tailored, I didn't really know what to do with it, which is another key point. I think as I've dealt with large companies, they haven't had the time to get as granular to understand our value proposition as we might expect them they would be, or even be interested in. And so we have to really take them a lot further in educating the value proposition and bringing it all together in a coordinated, cohesive way. So maybe we beat the horse here, but I think it's a tactic of showing up with a very tailored message.
Okay, good comments. So assuming that you've discovered a value proposition that makes both sense to both of you, and you found the prospective partner to be aggressive enough and understand your business operations and plan, that gets you to the point, it seems to me, where you can start to put together a potential relationship, at least with some short-term hooks and alignments. The question is, a small company and a large company will often have different strategic focuses. A young company may be just looking for their first big OEM and some fast revenue. The larger company may be looking for an acquisition. There are all kinds of examples where short-term you may be lined up, long-term there may be alignments that are going to cause problems down the road. Are those things you look for as you put together deals in terms of what the long-term red flags are?
So part of the problem is everybody who comes to us wants to either get an OEM or acquired, right? So you have to...
Do they start with that?
Yeah, well, you can tell they're going that route. And you have to set expectations real early and just explain to them, you know, that the actual number, the percentage of our partners that actually get to an OEM deal or get represented on our price list or get acquired are very small. Lightscape took you 5-6 years to get on our price list, right? They didn't give up, but it takes a while. And the important thing I typically have to do is set expectations early on, and you continually set expectations. And it's important to do that at the beginning. So I try to do that. But, yeah.
So we find when cultural alignment very important. So as an example, we covet our customers. We get a significant portion of our revenue, recurring revenue, from the customers that we've had for decades. And so it's very important that when we partner with small companies that those companies have a long-term focus. Now, that's a challenge because many times as a startup, you're struggling to make, you know, just the number for the quarter to keep the lights on. So when we look at companies, we look very much to make sure that they're taking a long-term focus, that they're not going to burn our customers by making rash, you know, you got to buy by the quarter, otherwise the pricing goes away type comments. And ultimately, that there's going to be cultural alignment there. What I found, one consistent theme with all of the small companies that have made it with SAP, is patience. Being very patient, working all of the different product teams, working the field teams, taking your time. Any of the companies that, whether it's they've gone through and they've made it to our price list or we've bought them, one common theme, again, is patience. So looking at that cultural alignment is something we definitely do very closely in the evaluation process.
Any other comments? Okay, so you've dated, you've gotten their attention, you're going steady, and decided to form a relationship. I'm actually very interested in what happens, because I've seen a lot of this in the work that I've done. I do a lot of alliance work. The power imbalance between in trying to come into your first deal, your prenup, between a large and a small company. So the question is, for small companies, how do you keep from getting stepped on or getting into a deal, just kind of saying, okay, I'll get into it, but it's a deal that long-term you're not going to be happy with. How do you work around that, given in you're in a less of a powerful situation? And on the other side, for a larger company, you have more power, but you don't usually want to end up in a win-lose kind of situation and start out with a partner that just feels like he's been trampled all over. So anyone free to jump in? How do you deal with that?
Sure. From a large company perspective, certainly we do have a lot of negotiation ability with small companies. However, to your point, John, we look very closely to make sure that the partnership's going to be successful. Otherwise, we're not going to get beyond the press release. And so it's very important to make sure that it's profitable for the small company. And, perfect example is if there's a revenue split between the two companies, if you strangle the company too much, they're not going to be profitable. You'll have made a big investment, they'll be out of business in 3 to 6 months. And so really structuring it so that it is a win-win and the company can grow and the company can continue to service your customers is critical, because when we look at doing a strategic partnership, we want to make sure that we mitigate the customer risk. So despite that, the ability to have the power to aggressively negotiate, being fair, making sure that the economics work for the partner and modeling it to show them that it works for the partner are pretty critical from our standpoint. And that was also the reason, again, that we founded the NetWeaver Fund, which is very much focused in on doing equity investments in companies as well to make sure that they could scale.
From my perspective, the large companies do indeed step on you. the five-year cycle to make the first transaction, the be patient notion, hear that time and time again. And sometimes, a small venture-backed company doesn't have the patience, doesn't have the time, doesn't have the wherewithal to afford that, and nor should they. They need action now. But the truth is, large companies work more slowly. That's the bottom line. So you have to somehow accept that. And going back to the earlier point about having some selfish set of goals, I think if you're clear on what those are, then you work toward those. The tactics that I've used to keep things accelerated is to set our own timeline, to set our own compelling events. And the best and most effective way of doing that is bringing actual customer transactional business to the table where there's a demand that's more pertinent than the timeline that the large company tries to impose. So if, for instance, you want to partner with Cisco, is there a large Cisco customer who indeed wants your product but also wants your combined product? And you've already pre-sold a possibility of a design point of this joint solution to this proposed customer. And then you bring that to your Cisco advocate, who in theory you've been working with side, to get some coaching about how to accelerate things. And then what you bring to the table is the customer needs a response to this proposal by the 15th of November or whatever. And all of a sudden the momentum is set not by the large entity, which is going to move at its own pace, but by the customer. And you're not the problem. You're actually trying to enable something. So it's a tactic that I've used to keep things accelerated, unless you're extremely patient. It's the only other way around it. So
one of the first deals that we did at Cisco after developing the software was that we got a call from one of the Cisco product managers saying, here's a law firm that wants this application, but one thing I want to tell you is this is your deal, you do it, we have nothing to do with it, leave us out of it. Right? So that was the risk. So we had no idea how to price the product and things like that. Talked to the law firm. Law firm said, we are going to send you the contract. So they sent us the license agreement. And there was a penalty in that if our software didn't work, we had to pay them $500 a day. Right? So I called the Cisco product person back and said, what should I do? He said, well, you're on your own. So that's the risk you take. Right? So with that, I said, okay, I'm just going to sign the contract. Worst case, you'll declare bankruptcy and go away.
So that's the kind of power you have that they don't have.
So we did the deal, and actually it turned out to our benefit because they became one of our best customers. But that's the risk. I mean, it was great to get the introduction. It was great to get the validation from Cisco saying, go after it, but you're on your own. So that's the risk we took, and of course the rest is history. So.
Well, so Rick, it's the other side of this marriage. We can play the marriage game here, and how did it look to you?
Well, I didn't give you that reference, but when I heard the question, I kind of struggled. I don't think Cisco does it great. I think we do step on our partners. So your point, big companies step on the small partners, and I don't think they do it without even noticing it. But you take our
generally not malicious, so I wasn't.
Yeah, certainly not malicious. No. It's just who we are. But the salespeople, as an example, they'll do something, which I'm sure Manoj has had examples of this, where, hey, I'm going to bring you into the deal to help me get the sale, and as soon as I get my sale, the salesperson's gone. And, you know, the partner's going like, what happened here? I helped you get the deal based on my advanced application, but now, where do we go from here? So one of the things I tried to do to help Lightscape out is compensate our salespeople now for every time they sell. So now maybe the salesperson will hang around a few minutes after he sold his main deal. So we try to do things like that. We're trying to get better, but I think generally we're not great. It's all about us, not about the partner. But I think the biggest thing we can do, and we're trying to change this, and I'm looking at ways to change this, is to try to give our partners better links and routes to market, connections to our channels, connections to our field, and try to find various ways where we can incent or compensate our field and channels to work closer with our partners. Because it benefits us in the long run if they do. But it's a constant challenge for us. Not stepping up.
Anybody else?
Well, one thing just to add to what Rick said was that, I've worked in the industry for a while, but one of the most aggressive companies to go after a customer or an opportunity is the Cisco sales team. I mean, they will do anything to win the deal, which is incredible because you learn a lot from that. And I remember one particular deal, one of the Cisco account managers called me and said, we have one of the largest presentations to one of the biggest hospitals, and I really need to get this thing done, so we threw this whole application together, and I had to send him my personal laptop in order to get it out. So managed to get it out there, they got it on time. I never heard back from him again. Right? He took me about a week to get my laptop back too. But that's the type of risk that you would run into. But the second time around, you get a little smarter, saying, if you want us to do this again, now you've got to pay us some money to build this for you, which ended up gradually becoming successful to start getting money from the various groups at Cisco to kind of help you stay alive or keep the lights on at that point.
Okay. So we've moved on. You've got the prenup signed, and you've got a deal going. What I'm interested in now is how you look at managing the relationship. Mostly I'm looking at governance, metrics, things like that. I think that's a key part of moving forward, and one of the things I'm wondering about is how you structure this with a small and large company, where perhaps a small company is just in such guerrilla marketing mode that they're not interested in any kind of formal governance. They're just moving 1,000 miles an hour. And how important is it, and how do you work a governance alliance relationship out of that?
So I think it's very important to start off with, a very clear business plan with the partner. And so when we partner with companies, we identify what are the key objectives. And there's obviously the financial objectives, the hard objectives that we want to meet on a quarterly basis and an annual basis, but also the qualitative metrics. So really putting in the qualitative metrics of the software business in particular. When is your product going to be built? When is it going to be integrated? Making sure that all of those milestones are met. And then having clear escalation paths. So to your point, when things are not being done, when there's a conflict, having a clear escalation path and then a pre-agreed upon resolution, path for resolution, and really making sure that the commitment is not taking place between the deal makers, right? But rather, you've got to get deep within the organization on both sides. So not just having alliance to alliance, but making sure the salespeople on both sides, the product people on both sides, are fully bought into this plan. And that's where most of the relationships go wrong, because they're done merely at an alliance-to-alliance level. And, you could have on both sides, sales organizations don't see any value in this, or they have very conflicting views. Or the product teams on both sides, one sees it as a priority, the other does not. So from a governance standpoint, making sure that you have this clearly laid out with a plan. You're monitoring it on a quarterly basis. And you have the extended set of stakeholders in these coming together on both sides and agreeing to this is very key. If you don't get deep and wide on both sides, it simply doesn't come together.
And do you find as a practical matter that you can get your smaller companies to put their effort behind that kind of governance structure? Because it is some bureaucracy, it is some work.
I don't see the governance necessarily as structure as much as guidepost for success. And without it, you know, you may not be chasing anything more than a Barney agreement, which, of course, all of us twinge when we hear that term, right? So I think that, I mean, what you just said is exactly right. You've got to get beyond just the alliance level and down to kind of this key stakeholders so that there's an operational plan that actually looks like a business plan, you know, looks like, and is that an administrative burden? I think it's a must-have. I think one of the other must-haves is some level of remediation. So, you know, if something is the brainchild of two really brilliant alliance people, and they do all the due diligence and bring the stakeholders together, but two quarters into it, we're not seeing the kind of results. Do we let the alliance kind of falter till it dies? And what do you do to remediate that and put it back in order and actually take action to reset a set of expectations that are more realistic and actually change some of the goal guidelines and even how you operate as an organization, actually take that into it. So that's one of the other things that I've had trouble with is the remediation and bringing things back on track. It tends to be let to go until it actually dies, and then you're exiting a relationship that was spent a lot of time on. So
this is pretty important, and it happens differently at different tiers in the partner program. If you take our top tier of the program, which is the industry verticals, or mostly the top tier of the program, there you have alliance managers, which do the typical thing, set up a business plan. It's revenue-based. You know, the partner's revenue is important, but the Cisco revenue is key, and then that's managed and monitored. And you have alliance managers that have, you know, four or five partners, you know, maybe more, maximum 10. But they're closely developing business plans with the partners, and there's metrics along the way. And revenue becomes a key indicator for both companies. And that really is the driving force, you know, how much revenue, how much value is coming out of this program. So that's somewhat the easy way, and that's the traditional way. The bigger challenge for us is how do you manage the other 200 or 300 partners where maybe they're not at the top tier, you don't have as many, you know, alliance managers to work with them. And we have governance models there. A lot of it is focused around certification. So, I mean, a lot of my program is a certification program where you're making sure that their product works with your product so that when it does get out to a customer's environment, it works. So that becomes a key thing. But we're also looking at revenue metrics there also. So things like deal registration, even for your, you know, partner managers. Partners who don't have, you know, dedicated alliance managers, you know, creating a web-based system where the smaller partners can do deal registration so that you can recognize revenue that they're driving. And that's how you get them from maybe the lower tiers up into the top tiers, right? But I think at the end of the day, for us, revenue and deals is the key indicator for success of the partners, not how much we like each other, even though we do like each other. Very nice job. But revenue is very important. And if Lightscape wasn't driving deals for us, he wouldn't be at the level.
So that leads to my next question. I actually got a number of questions, but I think I ought to end with one more and open it up to Q&A. But I think you're touching on what is one of the most important pieces of the whole alliance lifecycle and how to make things live so that you don't end up with a Barney agreement. And that is, how do you go out and make some money? Because that's what gets attention. So, particularly from a smaller company standpoint, trying to get some traction inside of a large company and get some deals and get some deal flow going so that their sales force will recognize the value. How do you get that cranked up? And maybe, Manoj, you want to jump into that first, and maybe Gamil.
Well, that is probably the most interesting part of any startup, you know, in terms of actually trying to get traction with a big company. Because one process that you follow is, you know, you have the entire partner program, you get the support, you get the certifications and things like that. But then the other side to it is, how do you go get, how do you make some money? Because at the end of the day, even if you went and you're looking for venture funding or venture-backed, you know, for companies to put money into you, I wouldn't even go to Cisco and ask for money. The first question is, how much revenue do you have? How many customers do you have, right? So that's the typical question that you get. So for us, given the stage that we were in the early days, it was a matter of, you know, going after, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I used to come down to Cisco, right? Pretty much begging at the door to get a meeting with somebody. I mean,
And giving them your laptop.
Giving them my laptop, right? I mean, I bugged Brian so many times, like just to get the attention, saying, take me to the customer, or let's figure out how to make some money. And then, you know, the perseverance eventually paid off in terms of being able to get it. And in certain instances, one of the interesting things was when you start seeing that Cisco is going after a Fortune 100 deal, and they know that that customer is critical for them, you know, as a big win from a competitive standpoint. And if you're able to jump on that bandwagon, which we did in one particular instance, then you manage to get Cisco to pay us money to go out and build that application for them, right? So there are so many different ways that you have to get creative, and trust me, you get creative in so many different ways in order to get their attention, right? I mean, the only thing I didn't do is dance in front of the buildings, but other than besides that, I probably tried everything else.
So I like your strategy, Manoj, because what I find is that the partners that do very well live at your large partner site. You know, literally eat in the cafeteria, spend as much time as you can with the account executives, and it's so critical that you share your customer references, that you have happy customers that you can refer to when you have a success. And with working with a sales rep from the partner company, very important, document your success. I've seen partners create brochures, literally like one-page slicks, where they use that to now sell to other account executives. I worked with one of your colleagues. We had a successful engagement. We closed a deal that was this big at such and such customer and put a quote from that person. And that those tools become incredibly effective. There's no better reference to a salesperson than having one of his other colleagues or her other colleagues that had a success story. And so making sure that the success stories are there and you evangelize the success stories, that's really where you hit the tipping point. Also, making sure that those customer implementations are successful. The bad news travels much faster, unfortunately, than good news. And so making sure that when you get those initial two or three success stories that those customers are happy and referenceable is critical, because literally you can lose all of the traction, all of the work that you may have spent 1 year doing on forging a relationship with one bad customer implementation. But some other things that are very important when, you know, getting your traction and you're out working with the field sales organization of your partner company is making your value proposition and your message very simple. You know, the account executives of most large companies are selling a broad portfolio of products, and you have to be able to keep it very, very simple. You know, what are the three things that this does to address a specific customer pain? How does it help the account executive drive additional revenue for their products? And what are the three prospecting questions, simple three prospecting questions that the account executive would need to ask in order to generate demand for your product? If it's anything more complex than that, you're probably not going to get off the ground. So these type of things and having your elevator pitch really clean is critical.
For me, it's first win. Identify the first win strategy. And the first win strategy has a couple key components. It's come from a position of strength for that customer opportunity. So know more about that customer than even your partner might. So that what you bring to the table is knowledge and insight about the transaction itself and that opportunity. Also work very regionally. So it might be a large company, global execution, etc., but literally perhaps thousands or hundreds of salespeople that you could work with. And while at some point you want to get to have an elevator pitch that's usable or consumable across the organization, you first have to create that win in that first region with that first salesperson who can demonstrate a value proposition to his peers. And so perhaps selecting an important region, an important sponsor in that region to help advocate the partnership as well. Beyond the alliance level, but actually at the field level. And then I think that speaks volumes to the point of actually understanding the partner and living there, to me, is living maybe not at headquarters, but living at a field level and understanding kind of the operational components of a sales process. How do the salespeople actually get motivated? What's interesting to them? What are they spending their time on? You know, there was an announcement 2 weeks ago, and that's captivating all their attention. So it doesn't matter how much time you spend with them. They're focused here right now. So you need to focus somewhere else then. That's not the right organization. So I think spreading too thin and all of that is the question. So really very narrowly focus on that first win. And then you move to the next level of evolution. So.
You know, one thing I'd like to add to Camille's point of the first win, it's we've seen very successful strategies of companies priming the pump, if you will. And that is you need to get those initial success that you can use to evangelize to the rest of the sales force. And oftentimes you simply need to bring the deal to the table. Maybe it's something that the large company didn't help you with. But it's an investment of taking a first deal or two, bringing it to them, using that as your showcase. And oftentimes some of the smaller companies have difficulty with that because there's margin pressures and so forth. But it is an investment that generally pays off.
It absolutely does not work to go into a region and say, will you please introduce me to your account? It's a non-starter. I mean, it's a complete non-starter. Don't go there. You know, it's just, which speaks to my position of strength. If you come to the table and say, I have an opportunity, it looks like this. Here's the timeline. I've been with the customer. I think these are the kind of use cases or effective features that they're looking for that I think we can bring together, and I need to hold a meeting. To actually get down to the weeds of putting together a joint sales strategy and a joint account plan, that's much more captivating.
Show me the money.
Well, it's quite specific. It's I have money to show you, and I have an opportunity, and it's real. And I've done the due diligence. I think coming to the table begging for attention is, to my point, a non-starter. There's too much of that every day of the week, and you know, just as we get spam email, it feels like spam, I'm sure. You know, it's like, I'm sorry, I just don't have time for that. I'm trying to close my own things, and if you need help, and if you're that desperate for help, what else is wrong? You know, what else is wrong about your business? So, I think the position of strength is a real critical litmus test for a small company to garner that attention.
Excellent point. Anything else? Okay, let's open it up to Q&A. If we can ask for a couple of microphones to pass out, and maybe you can share the two we have remaining. Questions? There's one back there.
Don't go too far, Rick, because this question is for you. I was interested in your comment about comping your account execs for sales of a third-party product, but then you extended it to comping your channel partners, your downstream channel partners, for the same thing. So I'm wondering how you fund that and what that kind of mechanism looks like.
I guess it's for me, right? So there is a solutions incentive program that we just launched here in the last few months. And basically, if for approved solutions like a Lightscape solution, you typically tie it to a vertical. Okay, so it's back to this vertical message. Obviously, you can see it's an important thing, right? So if a channel partner incorporates, for instance, a Lightscape solution into a deal, they will, and then they register that deal, they would get a, because they're reselling Cisco equipment, they would get a better margin, you know, better discount, whatever, on the equipment that they're selling. So they make more money off of Cisco equipment than they would if they didn't have a Lightscape solution in there. The reason why we do so, why would you do that? The reason why we do it is we believe, corporate, who puts these programs in place, believes that we'll have a better shot at winning the deal if you bring a solution partner in because you're being more strategic in how you're approaching the sale. And Cisco has a particular issue that we're trying to solve is, you know, our history is kind of routers box sales, right? So we don't have the issue. SAP doesn't have that issue, so they understand this thing, right? We've got, box salespeople, and we're trying to get them to be like SAP salespeople, you know? And so companies like Lightscape help us do that, and so we want to incent our channels and incent our salespeople, to get more strategic in their selling. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, but the revenue flow.
No, unless they have a particular deal set up with Lightscape. But it is real money to them because it comes in the revenue flow from Cisco, which is the, you know, the how many points they get, you know, on the Cisco stuff. Okay.
Another question?
Yeah, my question is about some large company. Let's say their name rhymes with IBM or something like that, and they've got a program where you pay for perhaps $100,000, $150,000 for a subject matter expert within the organization, and you get like a 10-city road show, and you've got this internal coach. You're actually buying an internal coach. Can any of you comment on the efficacy of those kinds of programs? I know Sun has an iForce program. Are you familiar with these kinds of things?
I'm not. I'm sorry, I missed it. So if you're buying an internal coach?
They actually give you three resumes to look at. The person has qualifications like they've been with the firm more than 5 years. You get to interview them and you get to choose a person. You're actually buying ahead.
Like within Cisco?
Like within IBM.
Within IBM. Yeah.
Microsoft does that also.
Right. Yeah. It's expensive. You're paying for a person's salary.
The third-party company is paying, right? The person that wants to do the alliance. I don't know, but I'm going to put myself out for hire. That's pretty good at revenue.
Don't
you anymore. Yeah, thank you. But no, we don't have anything like that. It sounds interesting. I don't know. Turn it around. I mean, Norma, is that successful?
I don't know. You're on that side of it too, Tom, with Microsoft. We actually paid someone's salary to be our internal partner manager is what it amounted to.
Huh. Unique.
Is this actually paying for a partner manager or a roadshow host?
Well, essentially it was for them to fund the body to be your partner manager.
Well, actually, we had a partner manager who was separate at the time. This was a person who... there were a lot of quotes around it. Don't worry, they're not a business development person. We wouldn't charge you for something like that. But in fact, what the person did was gave you the ins and outs of Microsoft, pitched you internally, and the fact of the matter is pitched the Microsoft new programs to you and try to keep you in line.
Keep you in line, yeah.
You know, with the Microsoft way, we did purchase one of those partner managers, and in the end it did pay. I do have some questions also about the efficacy of, don't worry, I'm not a biz dev guy that is paid, but then again, we bought one.
Rod?
Yeah, John, I want to come back and zero down a little bit more about cultural differences. There's just got to be a huge difference of a company like Cisco or SAP with all the bureaucracy and all the different people, maybe they're coming to the table at any meeting, and you've got maybe one or two people from the partner. Everything from dress code to the way decisions are made and the speed of which business transacts between the big company, the date.
I think cultural differences of different companies are important, and you got to kind of get know, and Manoj and I talked about this the other night, you kind of got to know the company that you're dealing with. I mean, the Cisco culture is extremely decentralized. And different companies are different. So you're dealing with a decentralized company. You don't be shooting for vice presidents to go get you anything because there aren't a lot of vice presidents. You know, director, manager level, or field sales rep. They're going to make it happen for you because that's who works at Cisco. It's like one of the cultural things, right? And then the second thing, it's not about bureaucracies at Cisco in terms. So, you know, if Manoj waited to just work with Rick in the partner program and follow some kind of, you know, it's. I tell my partner people, don't get out of the partner program. Go out and start visit. The decision makers are all around you. You need to get out and hit the various areas. So, understanding that culture, I think, is extremely important. And you know, the other cultural thing with Cisco is. We are a boring lot. They pay us a lot, but they work us very hard. Typically, the Cisco people are always blowing you off because they have too much on their plate. It's just the way, that's how they get the stock up. They call it productivity. So you got to get used to that, too. But if you understand that, then you just know that. And know that people aren't trying to think you're rude. They're just too busy, you know. And, you know, Manoj and team are persistent. So they keep at it, and they understand who they're dealing with. So understanding that culture, I think, is important. And I think every company has a culture, and they're all different. So
I think we have a question back there.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just one thing on the cultural difference. When, you know, I came from Lucent. So in the first meeting that we had with Cisco, and I was all excited and stuff like that. So I had a suit on and a red tie and things like that. And I walked into this meeting, and there were three Cisco guys all were wearing shorts. Right? It was Friday. It was the middle of summer. And you look, stand so out of place, and then you find out and say Cisco is leading a new revolution in clothing. You know, it's the T-shirts, the shorts, and this is in front of the customer. That was a huge eye-opener in terms of, you know, this is a cultural difference. You know, this is a big difference from coming from, you know, like Lucent. The second aspect to this, I think, at the end of the day, you know, if you look at from a cultural standpoint, yes, you have to deal with so many levels of bureaucracy and people and things like that, right? But the other thing also is that, you know, if you look at one thing, is that that account manager that you're looking for, he needs to make his quota. So at the end of the day, his difference is that I got to make my number. So if you can help bridge that in some shape or form, you become their best friend, right? So at the end of the day, for us, is rather than go look at the VPs and, you know, that level, is go and look at the guys who need to make their money. And that, you know, ended up being one of the biggest things that we made us successful from that standpoint. And getting guidance from Rickens, you know, what do we do here? How do we get there? You know, just kind of that made a big difference in kind of help figuring out some of those things as well. So.
Just to add to what Manoj is saying, I'm Brian McDonald at Cisco, and Manoj has referred to me a couple of times. So I wanted to share just some color to what, you know, from the Cisco side, working with, at the time, Circle 24, and then Lightscape, and using your dating analogy here with the event, you really, in a dating scenario, you really need to both bring something to the table, and that has been mentioned often. Well, so Circle 24, later, you know, Lightscape, Manoj, have done a lot of due diligence around IP telephony. I was managing the legal vertical at the time, and we identified, as has been pointed out, really the kind of the key pain points. We identified that the killer application within legal is time and billing. And the key pain points are, you know, reducing the costs. So certainly, you know, converged voice video data network helped law firms. And then productivity benefits. And squarely underneath that was time and billing. And so, you know, together with Manoj, you know, we looked at this. I had some understanding. Manoj had a lot of understanding. And I, as been pointed out, I had, I'm not going to say I had quota, but we had to bring in revenue for that legal vertical. And so I was highly motivated, and we put, you know, put an architecture together, showed the integrated solution, and there was, you know, there was the logo with Circle. Keep saying that, Lightscape. And, you know, and then we, you know, we went through very methodically. Here's the top 100 law firms in the U.S. and called on them. And if the value proposition was such that we needed to have, you know, Manoj go there, he was very, you know, he's on the next plane to Louisiana, things like that, you know, and Chicago. And, you know, somebody on his team that roll up his sleeve, Manav, that would go, you know, do the install. So, you know, because of that, legal became one of the top three voice verticals for Cisco early on. It was a beachhead. And we were able to then replicate that success and understanding to some of the other verticals. So, and this was kind of pre-funding and things like that, but, you know, the quid pro quo is that, you know, I think we were able to help, you know, Lightscape get some deals, and then clearly it helped Cisco get traction and be able to replicate success across other verticals. So I just wanted to add that color.
On the topic of culture, I think it's very important to understand the unique aspects of a company's culture and how they make decisions. So as an example, SAP, we have very much a, you know, a German culture, which is not the classic American top-down autocratic decision-making. It's very much consensus-driven. So, you know, much like Rick mentioned, not only not working with the alliance teams, but really making sure that you get all of the different decision makers on board, because we very much operate in a consensus-driven environment where you need to get the product teams, and they could be the industry product teams and the horizontal product teams and the field teams and all around the globe, getting everybody on your side. It's a complex web of relationships, and making sure that you get all of these various stakeholders on board. And this takes time, and oftentimes you may need to veer off the revenue track in the short term, and that is finding out what other priorities the company has. So as an example, one of the priorities that's important to us is our emerging technologies and getting companies to adopt that. So you may see an immediate opportunity of wanting to work with our field sales organization, but in order to be able to build a relationship, leveraging the latest technology, becoming a showcase for us, getting visibility, being on stage, that'll then get you visibility with all the key decision makers, and you can get things to the next level. So oftentimes it's very important to not only look at what your core objective is, but understanding what are other things I can do to start to build a relationship with a company that may not be help you with your short-term goal, but will help with you with a long-term goal.
So I think one of the common themes that everyone's talking about from either a big company or a small company is revenue. So, which makes a whole lot of sense. So I for a company where the board member had the acronym that it is. So the acronym was kind of like ASAP as far as AP. The revenue solves all problems. Especially if you're a startup, right? I mean, it's just critical to get the customers, get the customer acquisition, and get the revenue going. But kind of the question I would have, $1 million of Nightscape, that's probably a lot of money. I don't know, for $10 million, a lot of money, also for other startups, but for a Cisco or an SAP, that probably doesn't move the needle a whole lot. So, kind of my question is, for Cisco and SAP, when you're looking at alliance partnerships, what type of revenue is expectation for top tier partners, mid tier, and lower tier? And you guys break that by the revenue number, and also the key thing is obviously being able to provide a differentiation so you can meet the competition. It's kind of open-ended question, but if you have some comment on that, would be good.
So, interestingly enough, we don't view it as just the largest companies with the largest revenue. We actually, because we're very much have an industry-specific model across our 28 different industries, if you were to talk to the leaders of those industries, everyone would have a very different opinion on who those partners are. So from our perspective, it's about providing end-to-end solutions to customers so that we can win a deal versus a competition. So it may be, in some cases, a small company with a very small average selling price in some cases, but it helps us round out our solution and win a much bigger deal. So it's not only the specific solution that you may bring to the table, but it's really helping it tie together and helping us win a much, much bigger deal for the SAP product. So very important to map.
Leading that company up a little bit more bigger.
Exactly. So when you're positioning to a large company, it's very important to understand who are their competitors and how do you help beat the competition. How does your solution plus the big partner solution come together to create a killer process that allows them to beat the competition? And so that's equally important as a deal. Now, there's always things when you deal with account executives, your average selling price has to be reasonable for them to care about, right? So, SAP account executives have $5 million quotas. If your product is $50,000, you're not going to get their attention. So you've got to take those dynamics into account. But really looking at the big picture is important.
You're in tier one if you sell X million, and tier two, we're not doing it that much. It is more how much value you bring. Deals represent the value, but are you filling a gap, and is your product innovative, and then is it leading to deals? But I don't sit there and have published here's how much revenue gets this tier. I will say that there is one thing that we are looking at, and I'm looking to solve it, and that is how do you. And so the way I'm trying to get us to approach this is, if you take a company like Lightscape, how can I, across my entire partner community, make a determination if Lightscape sells a million, how much Cisco revenue does that lead to? Okay, and that's a very important number because it really tells you what the value of your partner base is. So we're trying to go through an exercise now to see if we can. Figure out, and some Manoj knows he's been through interviews and stuff, and there's a reason why we send consultants out to go interview them, is we do want to find out, when Manoj sells a million, what does it mean in Cisco business? And then if I can translate that to the rest of my partner business, then what I want them to do is to log their deals with us, but I'm more interested in how much they're making. How much did you sell last year of your product? And then if I have good algorithms and good metrics, I can translate that in what's the value for Cisco. It's easy to find your top partners, how much we're all making off them, because, like I said, you got your one alliance manager who's managing that partner. So everybody knows, but for the kind of unwashed masses out there, you know, how much value are they bringing in there? We're trying to find ways to really identify that value.
Just one other thing to add to that also is that if you look at Cisco and if you take a look, let's say they're chasing a deal that's $5 to $10 million, something like that. You know, an application like ours, let's say, costs $100,000, but that one little application will help them close that $5 million deal. Right? So, without like a good example of that is the law, the legal space, is that typically lawyers bill for every minute they talk to you. But without that application that we didn't have, it really helped Cisco close the deal, because without that they couldn't get there. Right, so that's some of the metrics that they're going through right now in various verticals, saying what is the value these added applications bring on. You know, I mean, eventually, what we hope is that also leads to an acquisition when they know the value of that part of the business. and just one other thing.
Well, you pay your alliance manager, maybe.
Are you giving someone a hint there?
Brian, do you have a question?
Things that, you know, we did initially, you know, especially going, you know, can you come here, can you come there? And we used to do a lot of that stuff. I mean, it's like you realize that Southwest is the cheapest airline that you can fly at the last minute. And, you know, those are the things that you realize. When you even look at, or ATA, or those are the airlines you look for those type of tickets. But initially, when you used to get a call, you used to like, okay, Cisco, they're dealing with, you know, a Fortune 500 firm. You're on the plane, you're all excited. But after about 3 or 4 months, you realize that, you know, you're just being shuffled around the country, but there's no money coming in, right? I mean, we can't survive being a startup. But then you eventually kind of hone in on, like, okay, if it's legal, you know you have value there. And Cisco needs you to sell the product. Then you start looking for those particular opportunities. And for the bigger ones, you know, you can look at Cisco and go, look, yeah, I got no money. If you want me to work on this, you got to give me something. And eventually we were able to slowly open Cisco's checkbook to start paying for those things. You know, not in the airline tickets, but at least in paying for some type of development or some type of marketing dollars to actually get and do some of those things. So at the start, you used to run around like crazy, but after a while, you start getting a little smarter in terms of managing that time.
Yeah, I don't think there's any easy answer. You, whether it's Southwest or ACA, you go. You know, you get there, you're very visible. And just going back to the point of the first win, I think you do everything you can to be as visible and aggressive as possible, overstep where you have to. That does have to evolve to a point where you turn the table. And I think, you know, where I've been successful there, you kind of sit down and this isn't going to scale. And if it doesn't scale, you know, and I break, then the opportunities break. So we got to do some skills transfer here. We got to really enable, you know, this to be more broadly understood, and mutually come to that determination. You know, I'm in Cincinnati this afternoon, in Miami tomorrow. It's just not going to work. You know, and we're going to break the opportunities here. So I think it evolves to that where it's obvious that you need to scale the resources.
We have time for one, maybe two more.
Yeah, I have a question, kind of a risk question to the Cisco and SAP guys. In a former life, we were putting together a deal with a small software company to create a software tool for our system that we were selling, and we were OEMing the end result, and that went along, you know, just fine for 4 or 5 years, and then the president of the small company got himself caught in a little fraud, and as the feds were coming through the front door, he was headed out the back door to a place in Europe that nobody could get to him with all the money, which left us high and dry without a product. And we had to then, the whole purpose of the thing was so that we didn't take our developers and go write the tool. Now we had to take our developers offline and go write a tool. So what things do you go through, or what processes do you go through to kind of protect yourself from, something like that, some fraud sort of pulling the rug out from underneath you?
So one of the things we look very closely at in situations like that is the financial viability of the company. So we do a thorough analysis of the balance sheet, the income statement, the audits, and in some cases, when we do an investment, we do deep legal due diligence, looking at the articles incorporation and liens against the assets and so forth. But it's very important. There is a tremendous amount of risk, because the moment you have two or three customers live, your downside exposure is huge. So really doing that thorough financial and legal due diligence is critical. And then, of course, having language in there, such as escrow agreements in the event that the company goes into bankruptcy, that you have access to the IP in order to support existing customers, is also critical.
We're the same way, code escrow and things like that, for OEM deals and things like that, in the due diligence. And sometimes you just take a risk. I mean, we take a lot of risks with companies that you look at their, maybe their infrastructure, they're a real small startup company, but the innovation is there, and they're going to help you get to a leadership position. So you just take that risk to code and escrow. And, but even with that, a company goes out of business, like, that would be great, what am I going to do with this code now, so you just take the risks. Sometimes it comes back to bite you. I don't know if there's any easy answer to that than the traditional due diligence, code and escrow.
So I'm not the only one that's had that.
No,
everybody has.
No.
Okay, I think we can do one more.
It's a question for Manoj and Gamil, actually. So I work for Cisco, and we're trying to incubate a program to, we'll talk offline about this. So trying to incubate a program to have smaller companies give us some creative use cases of how network intelligence can be used for developing net new applications or services. One of the concerns that I have is that, suppose I call you or you, right? And you're doing whatever you are as a startup or as a small company, and you get a call from Cisco, right? Obviously, there's excitement and stuff. How do you guys keep the balance between whatever else you were doing and all the resources that creating a relationship with Cisco would entail? Presentations, discussions, demos, whatever else. It's a tendency to say, oh my gosh, this is the biggest thing that's happened to me. Let's drop everything else. Let's do this. But what happens if the Cisco relationship doesn't pan out?
I'm pretty cut and dry. Thanks for the call. What does it mean to me? You got to be very careful with your time as a small company. And I mean, if I prioritize Cisco as a strategic partnership, then I want to know if you're an angle to get to that. And if you're not, then no, I don't have time.
But what my question is beyond that. So Cisco means well, everything is lined up, but to create the relationship would take a lot of resources, right, from your end. Can you balance that with whatever else you are doing in terms of your go-to-market efforts?
Not unless you can quantify the benefit to me, no. I mean, I'm not sure I'm following the question other than you're asking for whether we can balance the time to spend with Cisco versus some other partnership.
And factor the risk that the Cisco relationship may not pan out. At that stage, have you just juiced out completely?
Yeah, I'm going to be very judicious and determine whether or not there's accountable revenue that I can quantify in some time period. I'm going to qualify that call just like a customer. Is it worth my time? And be very cautious to say yes, because I know that it's going to take other resources. And in a small company, I think your resources are all at risk. It's a cost of sale of some level. It's a trade-off. And, would I rather have the resources on the phone with a customer or on the phone with a research discussion? That's black and white to me.
That's an interesting way of looking at it because, for example, when you get a call from Cisco, right, so there are, even the size of Cisco, So eventually you kind of, you know, working with them for 5 years or something like that, you kind of figure out who are the key phone calls you're going to take, right, to an extent. So if Rick calls, you better take a call, right, for, as an example, right? So then another good example is today, if an account manager from Cisco calls me, I would tend to quantify the deal a lot more, even past experience. I mean, even today we're working with some of the largest retail firms, but we have to really quantify it because we can spend cycles and years going around with nothing coming in. But on the other hand, you get a call from Cisco says, I'm so-and-so from the office of the CTO, you know that's important, right? You know, and it happened. I mean, it happened very recently. And so a lot of it is, you know, to an extent, after so many years, we try to pick and choose who is making that phone call or which group within Cisco is making that call. And if it's, and it happened very recently, the person who's making the call, 2 hours later, I was driving down to Cisco to do a presentation. Because, you know, you would put everything aside and go there no matter what, because it's who makes the phone call from Cisco. Right? Because immediately you look at it and go, that could be the largest opportunity we have. And then immediately you would follow something like that. So we've kind of got to the stage now where we start to quantify who makes that phone call. Right? That has become some of the key things. And if you, because you, after a while you figure out who the people are, you know, who the names are and things like that. I mean, okay, this is a joke, but if you turn and say you get a call from Ned Hooper's office, I would be down at Cisco in the next 10 minutes. Because, you know, it depends on who makes the phone call. So that's where you start working. And if it's typically like an account manager or something like that, today we are at the point where, you know, we're large enough, we have a sales force to say, hey, why don't you talk to our sales guys on the East Coast or something like that. So we got a little more, I wouldn't say smarter, but being able to figure out who is making that phone call. But trust me, we run when we have to run. You know, when you get the call.
Yeah, it sounds like you guys have two different approaches to it. Obviously, you're showing a lot more enthusiasm to it, and I'm glad it worked out for you. Gamil is a lot more judicious and careful, which my personal thing would be that I'm glad it worked out for you, but there is risk in that approach.
Right? There is a risk in that approach. I mean, you know, when you're a company that's not venture-backed, RSAP means a different story. When you're VC-backed, RSAP means a completely different story, right? So because they're saying, so how much money is it? That's the first question the VC will ask you at the next meeting, right? So it takes that thing, you have to kind of tie everything to revenue at the end of the day.
Can
well,
I ask an associated question?
One quick thing, if the VC does have a reputation, very responsive. So, I mean, I constantly had some, you know, references out here. I constantly get hit up by field and sales people saying, these guys are really good, they're very responsive. And I know how big they are.
John, can I ask you a quick associated question?
Sure.
This has happened with this company up in Redmond, right? And I'm not saying this as a Cisco employee, but in general, people are concerned, startups, you have creative ideas, right? Microsoft has rubbed some people the wrong way. How do you, in these kind of relationships, how do you make sure that your interest in IP is being protected?
You know, it's a risk. It's a huge risk because, you know, initially when you came up with the idea and you take it, I mean, we have gone to Microsoft too, right? There's no denying it. But you go to Microsoft, even when you walk in there, you're more scared of Microsoft than you're scared of Cisco. Right? Because at the end of the day, Cisco is not known for being a software shop. Microsoft, on the other hand, they'll throw a bunch of engineers and they're going to build it for you, right? But that's the risk that you run all the time. I mean, every time you go for a meeting, you always run that risk of saying, am I giving too much to it? And in this case, in some instances, you show a slide or, you know, you do something else. Next thing you see, it's on their roadmap. And then you know where that came from. And I saw this one particular instance, but that's the risk. I mean, that is the part that, you know, you have to. And the only benefit that you have is maybe you can get to the customer faster and you've built a big enough customer base that, you know, you have an edge over that. Or the other tactic when you're working with Cisco in the early days when you're coming up with all the ideas is that you think that, you know, all these people at Cisco know who you are. So if Cisco was to come up with it, you might have some protection from the sales guys because of all the work that you've done with them. But that's a big risk. I mean, every single day we face that, even today.
If we just go with the reputation part.
You go with, I mean, you know, your PowerPoint, you can put confidential all over it. It means nothing. A mutual NDA. I mean, God, I can't tell you how many I've signed, but so that, it's a big risk. And we still, man, that's a huge thing for us day in and day out. But you know, they said, did you sign an NDA? Yeah, I did. Okay, then you do anything you want. Just do it.
Thank you all for some enlightening questions. I'm sure that the panelists will be around for a little bit afterwards. We're going to have a little more networking and food. So there'll be another chance to kind of ask some questions one-on-one. I want to especially thank the panel for a very enlightening discussion. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And before we close out, I think I want to turn this over to Jim to close out the evening.
John.